This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for April 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scherer, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature highlights and readings from the upcoming issue.
April is our translation issue. We have a variety of English language poets translating a huge range of poets from all over the world.
Everything from Daryl Hine translating Ovid to D.A. Powell translating a poem by the Senegalese poet Annette Mbaye. Each translator has also written a brief essay to accompany the poem.
We started this issue 3 years ago, and we were able to get such good people when we commissioned these poems. It's turned out to be a good thing to do every year. Don, did you have a place that you really wanted to start?
Well, one of the poems that really moved me the most is a poem by the great Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva, translated by Sasha Dugdale. Now, Tsvetaeva's poems are very famous, and it may be that her work is familiar to many of our readers, but this is a beautiful translation, and in her note to it, among other things, Sasha says that it struck her that maybe Tsvetaeva had been reading Pushkin's narrative poem, The Gypsies, to her young daughter, Asya, and Sasha continues, or maybe the frustration of confinement had brought on a yearning for a nomadic life. I found myself, a mother at home with small children, enchanted by and entangled in the supple, sonorous lyricism of Tsvetaeva's waking dream. The reader is Eliza Foss.
Our sweet companions, sharing your bunk and your bed, the versts and the versts and the versts and a hunk of your bread, the wheels endless round, the rivers streaming to ground, the road. Oh, the heavenly, the gypsy, the early dawn light, remember the breeze in the morning, the step silver bright, wisps of blue smoke from the rise, and the song of the wise gypsy czar. In the dark midnight, under the ancient tree's shroud, we gave you suns as perfect as night, suns as poor as the night, and the nightingale churred your might. We never stopped you, companions for marvelous hours, poverty's passions, the impoverished meals we shared, the fierce bonfire's glow, and there, on the carpet below, fell stars.
You know, right after this poem, this was written right after the Russian Revolution, and the translator, Sasha Dugdale, speculates that there's some sort of prescience in the poem because Tsvetaeva ended up nearly starving in Moscow for those 5 years, and then she actually gave her child away to an orphanage thinking the child would be better off, and the child died.
The child starved to death in that home near Moscow 2 years after that.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, we were both struck by some poems by Håkan Sandell, the Swedish poet who founded, or maybe co-founded, his own movement, which he called retrogardism.
Yeah, I liked particularly this first poem in the issue. He calls retrogardism, I guess it's sort of the equivalent of neo-formalism in this country. This one is called Poetry Rejoices. The reader is Ken Marks.
Poetry rejoices, even if the culture dies. Over the girl with her first electric, how her high, thin voice, amplified many times over by the loudspeaker, is like a giant's in the green grass of the festival site. Over the fragile bells of digitalis, how they hide the pistol and the pollen inside. Rejoices over rain on the Faroe Islands, over rendezvous on the Champs-Élysées at evening. It rejoices over Japan, over Korea, over arts refined over 1,000 years, the art of swordsmanship or of drinking tea. Rejoices over the poet, that his heart still beats.
You can see a kind of retrogardism here that, the vision is of the culture dying, and yet the poet remains this essential heart of the culture.
Yeah, his translator here, Bill Coyle, says that what Sandell has done is not to enslave himself to the past, but to give himself permission to plunder its resources at will. So if he's a traditionalist, Bill Coyle says, he's one who extends the tradition by renewing it. We've also got a poem in the issue by Miroslav Holub called Creative Writing, which was translated by the author and Rebecca Bloyd.
On the express train to Vienna, she writes in her diary notes about Rome and Naples. Ink marks like parthenogenetic aphids, pages like blood smears of homing pigeons. She is alone, gray, reconciled. Alida, long after the swan's departure. Odysseus, retired at Lotophagitis. Back home in Maryland, the notebook will be interred in the archetypal drawer, among the yellowed love letters, among the infant hair curls, among the dried adult flowers, near the cushion where the castrated cat dreams, while Mahler's forever, forever, forever chokes in the green wallpaper. It is her message to imagined little sons. It is her membership in the club of Swifts, Goethes, Rimbauds, Horatiuses, and Death Watch Beatles. It is her monument outlasting bronze, five-dimensional reality, the last engraving of primeval man on reindeer bone, the last drop of the fluid soul before evaporation.
That was Miroslav Holub's creative writing, translated from the Czech by the author and Rebecca Bloyd. You know, I can't tell exactly what he means by creative writing, if he's being ironic. You'll often hear people emphasize creative writing, and they mean to denigrate it by doing that. Writers especially do that.
Yeah. Well, in the co-translator's little note, she says, and she knew the poet very well, worked on him in translating his work, including this one, before he died. She says that the poet here presents a person who aspired to permanence and perhaps epic proportions, but failed. And then she says, or did she?
Well, and it, you know, everything in the poem suggests a kind of, not just failure, but a kind, almost a kind of pathetic failure.
The notebook will be interred in the archetypal drawer, among the yellowed love letters, among the infant hair curls, among the dried adult flowers, near the cushion where the castrated cat dreams.
It's not just a cat dreaming there, it's a castrated cat.
While Mahler's forever, forever, forever chokes in the green wallpaper.
I love Mahler, but he can be plaintive. It's like you say, folded up with love letters and infant hair curls and dried adult flowers. It's all these things that are sentimental mementos,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it's a real question how you connect yourself with these epic poems and how you get your membership in the club. So the poem starts off
on the express train to Vienna.
And she's writing notes about Rome and Naples, but she goes back home to Maryland where she's got all her notebooks. And
yeah. Another poem that we have in the issue that I particularly liked was one by the Welsh poet Waldo Williams. And I was actually having dinner with a Welshman last night for Easter, and I mentioned Waldo Williams. He knew Waldo Williams, and I mean, not knew him, but knew the poems. And I was under the impression that Welsh was just dying. But he was saying, no, that was true, but now there's a great resurgence among young people and that kids are learning Welsh, and it's not nearly as endangered as it used to be.
Well, Menna Elfin, who translated the poem we're about to hear, says in her note that today Wales has an assembly, and the Welsh language, according to the latest census, is showing an upward trend with schools and TV and public authorities kind of exerting a bilingual policy. So here's an example where the poem really is an embodiment of a language that can spring back to life in many ways.
This is Waldo Williams's poem, What Is It to Be Human?
What is staying alive? To possess a great hall inside of a cell. What is it to know? The same root underneath the branches. What is it to believe, being a carer until relief takes over? And to forgive, on fours through thorns to keep company to an old enemy? What is it to sing, to receive breath from the genius of creation? What's work but humming a song from wood and wheat? What are state affairs, a craft that's still only crawling? And armaments, thrust a knife in a baby's fist. Being a nation, what can it be? A gift in the swell of the heart? And to love a country, keeping house in a cloud of witnesses? What's the world to the all-powerful? A circle spinning. And to the children of the earth, a cradle rocking.
That was Waldo Williams' What Is It to Be Human, translated from the Welsh by Menna Elfin. Really an astonishing poem.
Yeah, it has these rhetorical questions, and then you get these sort of oblique answers afterwards that aren't really answers. It has a runic power.
Yeah, the translator says that the lines here are memorable because they have a graffiti-like quality. It's sort of like slogans that you would paint on a wall. But it's also the case that in Welsh poetry and Celtic poetry, as she says in general, the poets sang their poems. And so here you have, and you can really hear it even in the translation, which is marvelous, a kind of aura of those songs, of the tunes. It's really joyous, but it's so thoughtful. It slows you down nicely. Sometimes you might think of a song as being a jaunty thing that moves you along. But what I like about this is that it just has a beautiful cadence that really gets you to slow down and think about the words and the images in the poem.
Yeah, there's some sort of anti-collectivity there. What are state affairs? A craft that's only still crawling, and armaments thrust a knife in a baby's fist.
Always a timely question. Being a nation, what can it be?
And the way the beautiful way the poem ends, what's the world to the all-powerful? It's a circle spinning. It's this endless energy that they can harvest. And to the children of the earth, it's just a tiny cradle rocking.
A cradle rocking. Yeah. And you can't help in our culture but think of Whitman there. I don't know if that occurred to Waldo Williams
or
not.
Yeah, that's a good connection.
Well, a lot of the time in our culture, when you think of translation, you must think of Robert Bly. He's still translating. And here are some new translations of his of Norwegian poet Olaf Hauge. And these poems really caught my eye because on the one hand, they do have something I think of in my mind as being Norwegian, and yet there's a poem that has a woodcut of the London Bridge in it.
Yeah.
So this is Barley Field by Olaf Hauge, translated from the Norwegian by Robert Bly.
An old woodcut of the London Bridge and a colored lithograph of a barley field. There are no other pictures on Ward D. The London Bridge lifts sooty towers above the river, but it's the barley field I see, a golden ocean of barley. It's not like the other grain fields. Maybe it's those inward-looking eyes gone into it so it becomes heaven? A fall-colored sky, mild, with no harvesters and no scythes.
That was Olaf Hauge's Barley Field, translated from the Norwegian by Robert Bly.
Poems can take you to many places. This one takes you to Ward D. I'm not exactly sure what transpired there or why they had this old woodcut that has caught the poet's eye.
Yeah, it has a kind of Zen feel to it almost, the end of it.
It really does. It's almost as if his eyes determined to see what he sees anyway in his mind.
Yeah. Well, moving from Norway to Vietnam, we have some very strange, striking poems by a woman named Ho Xuan Huang. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's actually from Nome. My Nome is a little bit rusty. It's translated by Marilyn Chen, and this poet in particular is from Vietnam, writing in Chinese-Vietnamese fusion, which is called Nome.
Wasps, where are you wandering to, little fools? Come, big sister will teach you how to write verse. Itchy little wasps sucking rotting flowers, horny baby lambkins butting gaps in the fence. Jackfruit. My body is like a jackfruit swinging on a tree. My skin is rough, my pulp is thick. Dear prince, if you want me, pierce me upon your stick. Don't squeeze, I'll ooze and stain your hands. Lamenting widow. A woman wails, boo-hoo, mourning her man. Shut up, shame on you. Don't cry to the hills. Oh, little sister, I should have warned you, don't eat the meat if it makes you cough blood.
That was Ho Xuan Huang in quatrains, translated from the classical Chinese and Nome by Marilyn Chin.
Pretty harsh stuff, huh? It especially to have been written when it was like 1822, I believe, is when she died.
That's right. The poems really rail against all kinds of things. Marilyn Chin says that the poems railed against polygamy, some profligate generals, and Buddhist clergy as well.
And she takes these symbols that are familiar from Chinese poetry, the dumpling and the jackfruit, and really takes them over for her own purposes.
Yeah, and it's sort of a nice act of completion and continuation by Marilyn Chin, who said that she was researching Chinese women poets for inspiration for years and experienced some disappointment trying to locate the right material to work with because of the patriarchal stronghold on poetry. There just wasn't much for her to work with, and then there was a breakthrough once she opened up her inquiry to the expanse of the Chinese Empire. And that's how she rediscovered this poet from Vietnam, whose work has come down to us in many controversial ways. I know there's lots on blogs and the internet about this poet and what language exactly the poems were transcribed in and whether they were transcribed or even written by the poet to whom they're attributed. So this is a continuation of these issues in Marilyn Chin's own work, where she's looking for what she can read as a kind of not only a feminist poet in some abstract sense, but a woman poet, you know, in her body, to have an arsenal in these poems against what is experienced as the patriarchy.
And so often that's what these poets that we contact are looking for, is some way of connecting to and honoring the past in their translations, yes, but also very much using what they find in their own work. I mean, there's almost a predatory impulse at play in translation. For if you're a poet, you want to find something that will further your own work. You loved that poem by Lydia Davis. Maybe we might have time for one more, right? She translated it.
I really did. And sometimes what our contributors came to us with seemed like what we might expect when we told them we were looking for poems for our translation issue. In this case, I think I was completely surprised by Lydia Davis's choice. Lydia Davis is probably better known as a novelist and also a translator of Proust. And I couldn't believe it when she proposed that she would translate a small poem for us from Catalan. And what she came up with was actually some words that go to an old Christmas song. And the reason she explained she was interested in it is that she was in Spain at the time of the Madrid train bombings just a few years ago. And there were massive demonstrations throughout the country in mourning for the people who died and in protest against the terrorist act. And one of the forms of the demonstration was a long march from an ancient Catalan city over to a river. And the marchers were very quiet, but every now and then, Lydia Davis tells us, a wave of solemn clapping rose and swelled and died away. And when this line of people reached the river, you could look up from the bridge and see people leaning out of the open windows of their houses over the water, banging on pans. And there were speakers, loudspeakers, placed along the route, and a beautiful melody performed on a cello with piano accompaniment was repeated over and over again. And it turns out that the piece was this old Christmas song, and the cellist was Casals, who is from Catalonia. He's called Pau Casals there. And these are the words translated into English that go with that melody. We don't know who wrote the words. It's anonymous. And this is called, in English, The Song of the Birds.
At the sight of the great light dawning in that glad night, small birds come singing to celebrate him with their sweet voices. And even the imperial eagle, soaring on the wind, sings a melodious song, saying, Jesus is born to lift us from sin and bring us joy.
It's a beautiful little poem, I mean, especially with the music. She says it's actually acquired a second life as a sense of the national anthem, right? The Catalan national anthem, just sort of accidentally.
Yeah, it's amazing. There, too, the continuance of something really so ancient that we don't know who wrote it, and it just comes down through us with a bit of a melody, is something that was completely revivified by current events, by something we experience in the news every day. And an alert writer, Lydia Davis, has come along and sensed this and decided to give it to us in English.
Well, that's it for this month's podcast. You can read all the poems and commentary we've been talking about in the April issue of Poetry Magazine and on our website, poetrymagazine.org.
Our readers were Eliza Foss and Ken Marks.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox with Ed Herman. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.